Okay, so so you, I guess behind me, because we're talking about migration today, and I actually don't know if I hacked this in right before the last time I gave this lecture, because right like the week of when I was giving this lecture, this group, the Schmidt Oceans Institute, happened to be in this undersea. Let me see if I can turn. Happened to be on this. It's a little dark here, but eventually I'll get over. Happened to be doing an undersea exploration with a remotely operated vehicle, and they happened upon this giant kind of herd of either migrating or mating crabs. I think it's just pretty cool to think about that there are these giant, it's like imagining herds of wildebeest that are just like at the bottom of the ocean, moving from place to place that you have no idea are there, but these massive migrations are going on all the time, and it's kind of a cool thing. So just oodles and oodles of these crabs. Anyways, migration will be something we talk about today, but first the admin stuff. So there's a perusal assignment out, and then the Canvas assignments as usual. Formation of your project groups are due this Friday. There is a spreadsheet on Canvas. If you go to modules, there's the final project module. If you open that up, that's where all the kind of deliverables are for your projects. And then underneath there, if you're having trouble finding someone to join your group, there's a spreadsheet that everyone has edit access to. You can go in, you can put your name down saying that you're looking for a group or that you've got a partial group and you're looking for an extra member. And then if you go back to that sheet, then you can respond to those who have already posted. And then if you do end up finding a match and your groups are complete, it'd be great if you can remove your name from that. So that ends up reducing the effort that I have to put into sort of forcing people together afterwards if there are people that are left over that don't have a group. Everyone has to submit that assignment. So even if you've joined a group with three other people and that one person's already submitted your names, I need confirmation that everybody agrees that they're in the same group. So everybody has to submit that assignment. So go ahead and do that. And so I have it due Friday, this Friday, and that allows me to see how things are going. And then that weekend, if there are those that are still kind of stragglers, then I can try to pull things together because then the next assignment will be coming up soon after that. So that next assignment is this submission of your selected organism and context for your organism. It's about 2 weeks after that. It's very short. This is a group assignment, so only one member in your group, once those groups are formed, will have to submit it. The constraints are no animals in captivity, so we're not talking about zoos. And a photo would be great if you need help identifying. So you're like, well, I see this animal all the time. It's some bird. I don't really know what it is, or it's a lizard I don't know of. And if you need help sort of figuring out what, animal that is, if you include a photo with it, then we can maybe try to help you with that. But it's not, it's not a zoology course. So, it's not about getting the right ID. But it's about sort of identifying that I found an interesting pattern. I think there hypothetically could be a connection to human activity that might have through behavior and impact on this organism. And so that's what I would like to investigate here. So we're not getting into great many details here, but just like, well, I'm studying these common grackles. And what's the context? Common grackles in the areas of grocery stores or something like that, and it's to sort of motivate why you're like looking into that. So this can change, so it's preliminary. I just want to make sure that you've got a backstop, that you've got something that allows you to build on. And then later you say, actually, there'd be this other cool system that would be even easier for us to work on, or more interesting, or it's got other directions, and you can switch to that. But I want to make sure you at least have something to go with. And then we'll take a look at that and say, all right, this looks good, or maybe this is something that maybe needs a little more thought. Maybe this is too ambitious, and so on. Provide some feedback of that. So that's kind of the schedule looking forward. Any questions about this? Yep. It'd be nice if it's from kind of the greater Phoenix metro area. You don't have to have access to it because you're not actually going to run the experiment, but it'd be nice if it had some sort of making use of place here, something that, it doesn't have to be in Phoenix. It could be something that you'd only see in Sedona or something like that. So it isn't necessarily just greater Phoenix, but it would be nice if it was something that was local so that it's not something you just look up a case study about something that's going on in Africa or something like that. So, I mean, my goal here is not only to bring in ConBio, which is sort of an aspect that I didn't formally make part of the class, but sort of show that connection. But the biggest thing is to give you practice coming up with causal questions, hypotheses, and a little bit of experimental design, coming up with those predictions. So that's kind of the goal. And if we make it local so that it's something that you can't already find, something that's pre-done, then it gives you better practice at doing that. That's the motivation behind this. Any other questions? Okay. All right. So we left off talking about navigation. So we talked about these Cataglyphus ants last time, very similar to the fiddler crabs, in that they leave their nest. They move in these circuitous routes while they're searching for food. They discover food and then they come straight back. So we talk about that, navigation is guided movement from one location to another using something, sensory information, landmarks, placing, when that location is a home. So what do we mean by a home? Well, a home is like a known resource, such as a shelter that's a central place within your home range. So it's a place that the animal frequently comes back to. So when you're navigating from an area to that one location you frequently come back to, we refer to that as homing. And so this is an example of homing, going straight back there. And these Cataglyphus ants are a model organism for studying this because they're so good at it. And they're relatively, it's a tractable system because they live in areas where a lot of the complex factors that other animals use for navigation homing are easy to sort of split apart because they live in an area where it's a sparse landscape. So you can add landmarks and take them away. It's a hot landscape, so they don't have the opportunity for pheromones. So that allows you to split these things apart and then study them in kind of the individual contributions to things like step counting and so on. So a lot of times, as we're gonna see, and many and we as we've already seen, oftentimes people don't choose the organism just because it's their favorite organism. It's because there's something special about it that makes it a so-called model organism. So Drosophila have become a real model organism for genetics because they're so easy to do genetic manipulations on. There's a toolkit for them. They reproduce very quickly. I mean, ants are not a great system for genetics because aside from, there's only one or two species we can breed in a laboratory. So you have to wait for them to kind of naturally turn over. And a queen can live for 20 or 30 years. And she's, maybe producing offspring every year or so, but so there's certain, wouldn't it be good model organisms for that? But fruit flies are not great model organisms for homing, but ants are. So, or these particular ants. So when I show you some of these things, they seem like, well, this is random. Why are we talking about ants now and crabs later? A lot of times it's because there's something special about the animal that makes it a unique experimental opportunity to study how life works. And then we then hopefully can generalize or at least come up with new hypotheses that we can then test in other organisms where those hypotheses may not have been as obvious if we would have started there to begin with. So that's what we mean by model organisms. So we'll see that over and over again. All right, so Cataglyphus, they're pretty good at it. They do what's known as path integration. So you can imagine there's different ways you could do homing. If you always knew that there was a giant billboard that said home above your house, then anywhere in the space where you could see that billboard would allow you to go to it. And you wouldn't have to remember anything about where you've gone. You wouldn't have to keep a map or anything. You just have to look around until you see the billboard and then walk to the billboard. That's one way you could do it. That doesn't appear to be how Cataglyphus do it. They do something that we refer to as path integration, where they keep track of all of their outward steps and they record them in some sort of memory so that when they need to go back home, then they can go straight back. And they don't actually follow the exact path. They maintain something that we call a home vector. So in path integration, the idea here is not to trace the exact path. So you can meander on these little paths here, but then if you need to go home, you don't remember necessarily the exact path you take. The thought is that most path-integrating animals are keeping track of a distance and a direction to home. And so they say, if I walk this way, my home is still that direction, so many meters, this direction, so many meters. So they keep an arrow that is pointing back home. And then from there, if when they need to go home, then they go straight back instead of following that path, if you're using pure path integration. And so what they've done with these ants is they've built experiments like this one, where their home is over here, and they put the ants in a channel. So they walk up here, they get to this channel, and they're forced to walk down the channel, and then down the channel again, and then they're released here. And then they are released, and maybe they give them a fly or something here, and then they see where they go. And what they find is that despite going down these channels, then this is a histogram of directions. So a few ants go off in this direction, but not many. A few ants go off in this direction, but not many. Most ants go off in this direction. And this is kind of the average direction here is this black one and this kind of this open triangle that you can't really see that's under that is the actual home vector, the actual pointing home. And you see that on average, the ants are going in the right direction back home. So despite having walked in these panels, they are able to somehow keep track that, as I'm walking this way, home is over there. They're keeping track of where home is. As they keep moving around, they're able to do it. So when fiddler crabs, they keep their body always oriented towards home. That's not what the ants do. The ants have something in their head which is seems to be oriented towards home. And that maintains this memorized home vector. That's what these ants appear to be doing. Any questions about that term, home vector? Is it clear what I mean there, that an ant or a crab is keeping track of distance and direction, not the whole path? And path integration is updating that home vector with every step. Okay. So we refer to that home vector as idiothetic information. So again, this is an example, a kind of a rudimentary example of a cognitive ability. This is a stimulus that is inside the animal. So rather than it being that billboard that's outside the animal that can respond to that, they are maintaining this internal information. It is changing over time, and they are responding to the internal information with behavior. And so the only way we can explain this behavior where the ant goes in this channel and then comes out and then comes out in the right direction of home, the only way we can explain that is if we assume that inside the ant's little head or body, there somehow is this memorized home vector, an internal stimulus, and that internal stimulus is guiding their behavior. So that's what we mean by idiothetic information. Not allothetic, as we'll talk about in a second, but idiothetic. It's inside the animal. Is that clear? Any questions about that? Okay. All right. So this idiothetic information, this home vector, it requires, in order to update the distance, then the ants need an odometer. They need to be able to do odometry. So an odometer, like not a speedometer like in your car that tells you your speed. It's like the thing that tells you how many miles you've driven for the whole car since the last time you reset your trip. And so, that is what we're saying is a physiological or mechanical device, mechanical for us, physiological for them, that allows measurement of distance traveled. And so, what's involved in their odometer? Well, it seems to be that they're counting their steps. And so I showed this famous experiment where they allow the ants to go out. When they're out, they grab the ants up, they cut off their legs, or they add to their legs, or they just pick them up and put them back down as a control, and then they let them come back. And the ones with short legs, they end up traveling toward home, but then stop early. The ones with long legs end up going toward home, but pass home, and then stop and start searching. The ones with normal size legs end up going directly, even though you picked them up and put them down, they still walk to home, and then they get to home. They don't have to do any searching. So that supports the hypothesis that they are counting their steps because we've adjusted steps, and the predictions go in the predicted directions. But it doesn't prove the hypothesis. So another test would be good for that. And so now they take the modified ants and then they let them go out and come back in. And so if they are step counting and they're modified, then the outward bound allows them to calibrate. You know, the fact that the out and the in are on the same legs should mean that they all will work equally as well, and that happens. So even modified ants, as long as they go out with their modified legs and come back in with the same legs, then they're able to come back home fine. So that kind of supports the idea that they're step counting, that their odometer, that the way they're measuring distance is through counting steps or some physiological proxy for counting steps. All right, any questions about that result? Does that feel convincing that ants might be counting their steps? And then the fact that, you know, even this idea of testing the hypothesis through these two different experiments, test one and test two, which have in both cases different predictions, that in both cases are consistent with the hypothesis of step counting. Okay. All right. So that's how the ants do it with the odometer. We think that fiddler crabs also use an odometer. We think the fiddler crab odometer is pretty cool in that it also adjusts for gravity. So they can sense when they go over hills and they, you know, so make it so that when you're going up a hill, then it actually adds to the step counter a little less than when you're on flat ground. So that's kind of cool that the fiddler crabs can do that, but still basically it's step counting. That's one way to form your home vector. Another idea or another option is to use so-called visual odometry or optical flow. Lots of examples of this in nature. Honeybees, this is they've, you know, there's been a lot of experiments where honeybees fly down channels, and these channels have been artificially striped so that it affects how fast things are moving on both sides of the honeybee. And you can then adjust, just like instead of extending the legs and shortening the legs of an ant, you can change perceived distance to a honeybee by changing the spacing of these stripes. So if a honeybee flies out with one straight spacing but comes back in with a different spacing, they perceive a different flow, and that conceivably can lead to them flying different distances. And so in that case, they're using the rate of change on their eyes to try to give them an idea of how far they've moved. And wolf spiders, there's a similar thing that goes on with them. So that's what we mean by visual odometry. Any questions about the difference here between step counting, this physical counting of steps, and then visual odometry, where you're actually watching things, feeling things go by your eyes? Now, there's one other thought that is less supported by literature, but there's a couple of examples, and that's actually trying to integrate effort expended during movement. So, the thought here is that maybe if you're using less effort, maybe you're moving farther. If you're, you know, expending more effort for, maybe you're not moving as far, something along those lines, or the other way around, depending on your ecological condition. So the thought here is if you blindfolded yourself, if you could somehow gauge, like, you know, that, oh, you know, I feel like I'm actually pretty exhausted. Maybe I've actually walked farther than, you know, than if I've been walking and I don't feel very exhausted, I must not have been walking very far. But if I've been walking and I feel really exhausted, then maybe I've walked, you know, 5, 10 miles or something like that. So maybe there's a way to calibrate your level of exhaustion, the effort expended, with the distance that you've traveled. So that's another hypothesis for how you could build an odometer based on perceived effort, based on the energy expended. But it's really kind of difficult to test for this one. I mean, these are relatively easy, and then, but this one is a little harder because you have to, how do you, you know, you have to sort of measure. There's a lot of confounders there, but theoretically speaking, you know, it feels right. Like from our perception, it really does feel like, wow, I'm really tired. I must have been walking pretty far. How far did I walk? Oh, wow, I've walked 10 miles. I better, you know, call an Uber or something like that. So it's kind of an example there. So those are three possibilities for how you could build an odometer, and there could be others, but those are three common ones that come up a lot. Any questions? Odometry, path integration. Okay. So now that's idiothetic information, but even cataglyphous ants still could be using allothetic information, could be using external cues. What's so great about them as a model system is that they live in areas that do not have many landscapes. They look pretty much like this. This has been added, obviously, here, but usually there's very little landscapes that's out there. So you can you can test for the step counting without having to worry about these confusing, details about, well, maybe landmarks are helping them out. But another nice thing is that you can add landmarks in and see, do they have the ability to use landmarks or use their visual landscape in these other ways? And so this is an example of blending idiothetic with allothetic information. So there have been studies here like these, where also on cataglyphs, where they study the effect of landmarks on their ability to come to, on their homing ability. So landmarks here, I'm just defining as prominent physical features created by the animal itself, possibly as in scent marking, that can aid an animal into orienting towards an important location. So ants can scent mark. I mentioned some fiddler crabs build turrets next to their burrows. No one knows what they're for. I think they don't appear to be aiding, or at least they haven't detected a signal that they are aiding in path integration, but you might imagine that they do. They don't appear, as far as I know, to be helping with sexual signaling, but maybe they do. I don't think anybody knows. I might be out of date. I don't think anybody knows what the turrets are, but that'd be one hypothesis. The reason they build these turrets next to their burrows is to give them another visual cue. So, that's one option here. So you can create your own landmarks, or you can use existing landmarks. So in this experiment, they, you've got the nest here, and these ants, they went out to a spot, and then they displaced ants to different positions. So they're like labeled here. And based on the displacement, then they watched then how the ants recovered from those displacements. And then they saw, if, could we predict their features of their return paths that have to do with landmarks. And they found some signals there that when landmarks were available, that ants were able to use the landmarks to get back to the kind of main path. And then once they were there, then appeared to use some sort of path integration to then get them back to their nest. So it does sort of suggest that these ants are using, landmarks. And I don't think I talk about it in this lecture too much here, but there have been other studies of cataglyphs that show that they memorize landmarks on the outgoing path, and then they memorize landmarks, a different set of landmarks on the incoming path. So you can let them go out and back. And then you can put landmarks out there, and then you can move the landmarks around, and you can then see if you move the landmarks around, are you affecting their outgoing paths or their incoming paths? And you find that different sets of landmarks affect outgoing differently than incoming. So they're apparently taking, their memory is not only trying to do the step counting internally, but they're also keeping track of landmarks and different sets. And it's not like they're just reversing them in their head. It's like, on my outgoing route, I remember I saw these things. On my incoming route, I saw these other things. And those two sets of landmarks don't necessarily connect. So it's a tiny little head, but it turns out that there's quite a lot of memory there that could apparently be stored in these little heads, and then used for navigation. So landmarks, that's one way to do it. The alternative way to do that is very similar, is snapshot orientation. So this is a little, it's a little confusing when you like, what's the difference between this and landmarks? But it's the idea here that if I look at this image, I could be using that landmark, or I could be using this view. And so there's this, and sometimes these two hypotheses have different predictions. So the idea here is that, so you could alternatively navigate by trying to match remembered views to what's going on here, as opposed to looking for specific landmarks. If you're looking for specific landmarks, the view might be totally different, but if you move the landmark, then you'll be attracted to that landmark if that landmark is your way home. But if you upset the view by moving the landmarks around and you use these snapshots, if that totally looks like a different snapshot because the landmarks are in different spots, then it's not going to be helpful at all. So there's two different ways you could imagine. And we know that robots, for example, they often use snapshot orientation in order to do navigation. Not necessarily, landmarks. Now we're getting more advanced vehicles that are able to identify specific landmarks and use them. So if you move them around, they can reorient based on that. But generally speaking, the old-fashioned Roombas and things like that, that started to use vision, they would more be interested in just what's the shape of space around me. So it's more a snapshot than specific objects. So those are two very different hypotheses. So, and then they did some tests and found that I think there is some evidence for snapshots. And I won't go into just sort of, if you're interested, you can kind of check out if you click on these things, it'll take you to those studies. But I'm mainly interested in you sort of just being understanding that this is an alternative hypothesis for allothetic information use. So questions about that? Is it clear what I mean by difference between landmarks and snapshots? Kind of the whole picture versus specific objects. Okay. Now, other things that you can use, it's not all vision. So, one of the cool things that these lobsters use is magnetic maps. So, they're able to, and so this Bowles and Lohman article showed that these crabs are not just using compass information, they're actually using like they apparently can perceive magnetic fields like the way we perceive topology. So when we look out, like if you're driving up the 17 and you look out and you recognize certain peaks, or when you look out, if you're driving east on the 60 and you see four peaks, something up there, you recognize certain things. You can use that. Like, oh, I see four peaks. I know I'm driving east from Phoenix. If I, there's certain aspects of, the 17, if I'm driving north, I expect to see certain things. You can, that landscape ends up being something you can use to navigate over large regions of space. They apparently do that with magnetic fields. So there are certain reproducible patterns that, like in different, or if you go to like, around the tip of Florida, up the Carolinas, if you were to take a fine-grained snapshot of what the magnetic fields look like there, then there are little perturbations, little changes, little variations that are just like mountains that we can perceive with our eyes. And they were able to reproduce some of those variations in the lab and show that the lobsters responded as if they were at those locations. And so they were to train these lobsters to behave in a certain way when they're at certain locations, generate the magnetic fields of those locations, and then the lobsters were able to respond in the right way to that. So they're actually not just sensing direction, they are actually able to perceive these little microscale variations in the magnetic field. So they build a so-called magnetic map, which I think is really cool. It's not something that you might expect in this lobster here. So they might not be using their visual information quite as much as we are, but they're using the umwelt of this animal. They're using magnetic information in just as much detail as we're using our visual information. That thing is pretty cool. So magnetic maps. Now, as I've hinted at, a less sophisticated use of magnetic information is magnetic compasses, and there are plenty of animals that appear to use compass information as well. So if they know, where north and south is, it seems to help them in their migration routes. It doesn't help them locate necessarily a specific position like the lobsters do, but it may help them make sure they're going in the right direction. And so you can find that different animals have the ability to perceive compass information. So that's still we view as an allothetic cue, but it's just not being used in quite the same way. So magnetic perception, magnetoreception as allothetic information for navigation. Any questions about that? So magnets, vision, snapshots, and so on. And then you read about this in the reading assignment, these dung beetles. And here's a picture. If you didn't notice this in the article, here they were able to put tape over the dung beetles so that they couldn't see up, but they could see forward. And this, along with other manipulations, allowed them to show that the dung beetles are using the stars or navigation. And so that's something that, again, you'll read about in Perusal if you haven't. So if you've got the starry sky visible, then you find you get the dung beetles having relatively repeatable routes when they're rolling their dung. But if you occlude the starry sky, if you go into the planetarium and you close that up, by the way, there's a new planetarium, they just, or the new dome planetarium in Phoenix, I think, has just opened. So it's like a, it's kind of like the Vegas Sphere, but they, it's a smaller scale version. So it's like a full color planetarium. So check that out if you're interested in that. But you know, they basically use the planetarium to change the sky that the dung beetles have. Now, the dung beetles don't have an innate, they don't appear to have an innate representation of like what the Milky Way looks like. But it looks like they maybe calibrate, like, you know, when they need to start rolling their dung, they can kind of calibrate to what the sky looks like right now and maybe adjust for that even as the sky moves. And so if you get rid of the sky, then they can't use that information. So that sky compass is gone. And so then they get more circuitous routes. So that's what we mean by that. But you read about that in the reading. And then during the daytime, you know, again, the umwelt of these animals. When you look up at the sun, you see a big bright dot in the sky. Animals that can see polarized light see concentric circles around the sun. And so even when it's cloudy out, so if you can see the sun, then you can use it as a navigation point. You can say, all right, I know where the sun is. I can figure out roughly, you know, where east and west are based on the time of day and where the sun is. But if a cloud is obscuring the sun, so you don't know where it is in the sky, then that, you know, maybe it's a lot harder for you to do that. But imagine if there's a bullseye that is centered at the sun, and when you look up, you see circles that radiate out from the sun. There are animals that can see polarized light, not us. And that polarized light, the way the sun hits our atmosphere, it generates these circles of polarized light and it radiates out from there. So even if the sun is obscured, if you look up at the sky and you see all these circles, you trace the circles back to their center. And even if you can't see the sun, you know the sun is there. And so that allows you to have a sun compass that gives you the idea of where east and west, north and south are. And if you've got some awareness of time. So, you know, a lot of cool things have to be going on in these animals' brains in order to make use of this information, because they have to know roughly the time of day in order to correct for that. And then they have to have the perceptual systems to be able to pinpoint these locations based on these other cues that we're not aware of. So, is this clear what I mean by the polarized light, how it creates these concentric circles around the sun that on Earth, then? So, this is sort of looking down at the Earth, and you can imagine the sun is brightest at this particular point and it's forming these circles. So, if you're on the Earth looking up, then, or, you know, I guess this you could also view as looking out at it, then you see these circles formed around the sun. Sun compass. Another idea of aletheic information. And both of these we group under celestial cues. So either stars at night or the sun during the day. Now, in this article, they mention that, you know, the Milky Way might be particularly important for this animal. And again, I think I want you to emphasize or think about the limitations of their sensory system. And so the Milky Way, I don't think, you know, they're not saying there's a particular pattern in the Milky Way, but it's the fact that the Milky Way is like the brightest thing in the sky, at least before light pollution's added in, right? So if it's the brightest thing in the sky and the skies that they're used to, it's a little bit like a sun at night. And so it's not so much that it's a particular pattern that it's the Milky Way, but it's the fact that it's this very consistent line that's going across the sky. And that gives them a navigational cue, just like the sun and its concentric circles do for things during the day. All right, any questions about that? Celestial cues used for navigation. So when you see an animal navigating, these are all the things you have to worry. Like if you're trying to test these hypotheses, like if you see an animal doing path integration for the first time, but the guy who studied those Cataglyphus ants, originally he went to Germany to study honeybees. He was studying something else about honeybees. It wasn't working out, but he happened to be in the middle. He went to Germany, but then he was doing the field work in Africa, and he happened to see these ants. And while he was doing honeybee stuff, these ants were wandering around, and then he watched them. They all walked back in straight lines. And that was a really interesting pattern. Like when you see an animal walking in a straight line for that long, like for miles, like walking in a straight line, then it's like, how is it doing that? And so, those mechanistic hows, I've just gone over like six different hypotheses for how you might be using information to do that. Idiothetic and allothetic. So these are the reasons why we go over this. It's like these are the common tools that many animals use, but there could even be more. But you always have to go, you have to count these out. Are they using polarized light? Well, let's, you can build a laboratory setup where you give them access to polarized light or you block out all the polarized light and you can see if it affects their navigational ability, just like the planetarium. And then if it doesn't affect their navigation ability, okay, so polarized light, they're not using that. Let's move on to the next and the next and the next. But that's why we go over this, because every time you see an animal navigating, it could be any of these things. Okay. And then you can mix all of these things, which makes it even more complicated. So we think that most animals, like these honeybees, use a combination of them. And so we try to study them in isolation. That's why those ants are so nice in that desert environment. Honeybees are nice because they're so easy to work with in the lab, relatively speaking. And so you can control their sensory experience with these tunnels and other things like that. But then you can then mix in things in different amounts, and then you find out that they're using a little bit of odometry and compass cues, a little bit of view-based cues. They're mixing them all together and coming up with some sort of common heading direction. And this redundancy means that if you just knock out one but not the rest, you might find that they still are able to integrate, path integrate fine, or they're able to find a direction fine. And so you have to be careful. Like just because you've knocked out polarized light, that doesn't mean they're not using polarized light if you've also given them other things they could be using too. So you almost need to give them like a completely, a total void, like a white room with absolutely no features at all, except polarized light versus a totally white room. And if they work in the polarized light, then they're using the polarized light. But if you give them all sorts of other stuff and all you take away is polarized light, they could be using other things to compensate. Just like, I definitely use vision to walk around, but if I close my eyes, I can still do an okay job getting from point A to point B. And if, and people who don't have access to their vision, they compensate by using other sensory modalities and they're pretty good at it. So that same integration is going on, that same complex mixing of cues is going on inside most animals. And that makes it really hard to figure these things out. All right, so yeah, homing pigeons are a great example of that. So homing pigeons are these miracle animals that have an innate ability to be able to, like they somehow have genetically assimilated maps of the Earth or something like that. People still don't quite understand how homing pigeons work, but you can take a homing pigeon from their home range, drive them blindfolded in a truck miles and miles and miles away. And I think you'd probably even knock them out while during that drive, so they can't even experience the bumping or whatever. And then they get to some location, you let them free and they fly back home. That's why they're called homing pigeons. And so that's why they've been used to deliver messages, and things like that. You can just bring them with you, and wherever you are, you put a little message on them, and then they will fly home. And if your recipient is at their home, then they'll receive the message. And they appear to use lots of different cues, so people are using them as a model organism for understanding the crazy things that animals can potentially do when they're doing this navigation. They also use social information. So, if multiple of them are flying together, then they learn from each other and their routes get better over time. So it's not just the allothetic and idiothetic information on an individual, but it's also the social pooling of all of that information seems to be important. So a lot of crazy things going on with pigeons. So it's good to know about them as a great model organism for studying navigation. And so I mentioned maps in a lot of these. And so we talked about the cognitive map in those rats, Tolman's rats. And so people are pretty sure that there are cognitive maps that are formed inside the pigeon's head, or maybe even somehow innate maps of certain features of the planet that allow them to navigate so well, just without even having to learn a lot of routes. There's an open question of whether invertebrates like the ants and the crabs that we have form cognitive maps. So it continues to be a matter of great debate. It's really difficult to test. So could be, could not be. It's hard to tell. So it's but it's a possibility. So again, it's another hypothesis that you have to entertain, because it if it works so well in one animal, then why not consider it in another animal? Just because they're tiny doesn't mean they might not have the ability to do it. All right, so any questions? That's our navigation before we move on to more longer scale movement. Okay. All right, so I showed those crabs. We think that one of the things that are probably going on with those undersea crabs is that there's migrations, massive seasonal migrations from one point to another. That might be what's going on. It could be seasonal again, or it could be a mating aggregation as well. It's not necessarily migration. It was a surprise when that ROV found them there. What is migration? So migration is large-scale navigation. And you don't think of it as homing, where you're going back to a central place. It's that, but you are going to an area that is usually important for a large group of animals to go there. So it's usually periodic, usually each year, and often between two seasonally appropriate habitats. So maybe you're moving out of the cold into the warm and then back into, so you're kind of trying to regulate your temperature. Often involves stopovers. So it's usually really long. And so those stopovers allow for refueling. And usually migration is not a one-way street. It usually comes back around to your original location. So that means there's typically established migration routes. Some of them are innate. There are routes that are somehow built in. I'm going to give an example of that, where there is no ability for them to learn them, but they still know that we're born here, we travel here to mate, and we come back there to have offspring. So all the offspring are here, all the mating is there, and they go back and forth, and that route is somehow genetically determined. Others are learned. So learned by routes exposure. And so we've seen that with those whooping cranes. Those learn their routes from their parents, but there's other things that it's genetically, it's in there. It's typically allothetic, so typically it's making use of information from around them. So, and a great example of that are the monarch butterflies. So this is a crazy system. So there are these two morphs of monarch butterflies, a really big monarch, and then these little monarchs. And so this appears to be a genetically encoded route. As you'll see, there's absolutely no way they could learn this route because of how the life cycle works. So how does this work here? So you get these migrations, these really large monarchs that are up here in, say, in Canada or near Canada, and they then fly down to this area here where the reproduction's going to happen. So that's where their mating's going to happen. And they have to go this whole route themselves, this one-way journey themselves, all the way down here. And then they reproduce and die. So they travel this route here, and then they reproduce, and then they're gone. The big monarchs don't come back. But they then have little monarchs. So then there are these little monarchs that then from this location go up. But they're so small that their lifespan is only a part of the route. So you get one monarch goes up here, and then you get it then reproduces and dies, and then another set of small monarchs reproduces and dies, and then another set. So I think there are three small butterflies and one giant butterfly in the life cycle, if I got that right. And so no monarch, no butterfly sees the whole route. Most of them see a small fraction of the route. And yet they all come back to this same location here, to all the big ones come back to the same location here, and they all go back to roughly the same locations where they started. So this amazing thing. And they get tattered, so this is a really tough route. So it's pretty cool that this can happen here. So, where is that stored? How is that encoded? Where is the what is the genetics of location? The genetics of the cues for these things to work. What cues are they using? Those are great questions to ask here. So there are people that studied that, and that's where we're going to go on to the next slide. But any questions about this life cycle? Is it clear I'm saying that their life cycle has got these four morphs, and each morph only sees a part of the migration route. It's kind of cool that they even know that, the little morph knows that they're not the first little morph, or they're the first little morph, but then the second morph knows they're not the first little morph, they're the second, So it's like they not only know location, but they kind of know like where they are in the relay race, which is, I think it's really cool. So people are interested in how they do this, and it appears that they use a time compensated sun compass. And so what you can do is you can take these monarchs and you can put them in the lab, you can kind of hang them so that they can fly in place, and you can adjust it so that you can see their orientation. So they're flapping their wings and adjusting their orientation, but they're not actually going anywhere. So it's a little bit like a monarch treadmill in the air. And you can then see, what direction do they tend to point. And you can orient the sun. So I think down here is the correct orientation. So you can orient artificial light in the laboratory to point where the sun is currently, and they will then fly in an orientation that correlates to that. But then in the lab, you can shift the sun by 6 hours, and they'll then fly in the direction that they fly 6 hours earlier in the day. So you can watch what their normal pattern is. Like you just, just put them in the lab and have them fly without manipulating the, using the real sun. And then you can see how that, what direction they pick. But then you can generate artificial sun, and you can find that you can, if you give them the direction of the sun from 6 hours earlier, you get the direction of the monarch from 6 hours earlier. So it suggests that they're using a sun compass to figure out their direction. So this genetic, the genetic writing of the navigation is apparently writing down a response to the sun. That's what is, in their gene. This is how to respond to the sun on each one of these routes, apparently. So, they're using a sun compass, we think, but they could also be using other things along with it. They could be using magnetic fields. There could be a little bit of visual component, probably. It seems like that would be really hard. How would that work? But the sun is a very clear cue that would be available and available across multiple generations. So it wouldn't be like, if they build a city here, then suddenly it upsets the migration routes, because as long as the sun is there, the migration routes are still constant. So any questions about that? The sun compass use by the monarchs. Okay. All right. And then the other form of motion, dispersal. So migration tends to be two-way movement. Dispersal is one-way movement. And it's usually not a whole group of animals. It's usually a subgroup of them. So for example, in prairie dogs, that tends to be the males are the ones who disperse. And so colonies are matrilineal. So colonies are inherited by daughters. A mother has a bunch of offspring. The daughters stay back. The males go elsewhere. And the males disperse, and they then outbreed after they've dispersed. So dispersal, movement away from a natal home to avoid competition or inbreeding. So honeybees, for example, they're the colonies that I don't want to call them daughter colonies, because it turns out that it's the main queen that leaves, but let's just, for sake of, to make it easier, we'll call them daughter colonies. They try to get away from the colony that they started from before they start looking for a new home. And that apparently helps prevent competing with their initial home, and then also maybe helps with this outbreeding. So dispersal is important. Questions, key questions to ask here is, do parents or offspring disperse? So I just mentioned in honeybees, in European honeybees, not stingless bees, the queen can fly. So in that case, the parent, the queen who had the old nest, she disperses and leaves the new nest for the young queen. In stingless bees, another type of bee, the queen is unable to fly. She becomes really what they call physogastric. Her abdomen becomes distended as she starts producing eggs, and she's unable to fly. So the old queen has to stay wherever she originally was, and the new queen has to go out. And then there's a whole set of adaptations that make that work. So those are key questions. Do parents or offspring disperse? And then do males or females disperse? So there's a bunch of animals where males are the dispersers. There's a bunch of animals where females are the dispersers. So those are kind of the key questions or hypotheses to test when you notice a dispersal pattern. Okay, questions about that? Dispersers, different than migration, they don't come home. They go west and they never come back. Okay. All right, so not a lot to talk about today. There's kind of when we talk about large scale navigation or large scale movement here. I mean, we kind of touched on navigation here as well. I mean, things I want you to take from this. I mean, know about these key organisms, these model systems for studying navigation. Cataglyphus ants and homing pigeons, those are big ones. Fiddler crabs is good to remember too. These are things when people talk about navigation, those are the animals they have in mind because they're such easy systems to work with. Know the difference between idiothetic and allothetic information, this key idea that am I using an internal thing that I have to maintain or am I just using external cues? If you're using external cues, what are the external cues? So, they could be lots of different visual things. It could be magnetic, it could be the sky. There's all of these different things. And then migration versus dispersal. So there's homing, but then there's also you need to go much farther away. Very different type of navigation. Yep. Yeah, so the idea is that if you know where, so I mean, sun generally, rises in the east, sets in the west. So if you know that it's the morning and I see the sun, then that sun tells me that east is over there, wherever, not, see, I didn't enjoy orientation, somewhere, let's pretend it's over there. So then I know since it's morning and I see the sun, then that's the east. If it's evening and I see the sun, then that's the west. So then the idea there is if the butterflies can sense where the sun is, then if they know they need to fly south to get to Mexico, then they then orient. So they keep in the evenings, they keep the sun to their right. In the mornings, they keep the sun to their left. And so if you know the time of day and where the sun is, then you can hopefully figure out where south is. That's kind of what we think they're doing. So in the lab, you can generate fake suns. And so you know that the butterflies, may have an internal sense of time. And so if you know their internal sense of time and you can generate where there's sun in different places, then you can manipulate how they're responding to that. So if I then put the sun over there and it's the morning, then I might expect the butterfly to turn around because it wants to keep the sun on its left. But in the evening, it'll want to keep the sun on its right in order to go south. So if I manipulate the sun in the lab at different times of day, then I would expect to see the butterfly turning toward the sun and away from the sun if they're using it. Other questions? All right, so we have one more movement lecture, I think, E3, and then we'll move on to foraging, which is a favorite of mine. Reminder, final project groups due this Friday, so definitely check out that spreadsheet. And otherwise, I can get you out a little early here. So I'll do this multiple choice. All right, so A, B, C, or D, which of the following animals are known to make a magnetic map? Is it the spiny lobster, the prairie dog, Homo sapiens, or Cataglyphus ants?